Welcome to Versus History with Elliot Watson and Patrick O'Shaughnessy.
Good afternoon and welcome to Versus History. I am Dr. Elliot L. Watson and with me is Patrick O'Shaughnessy as ever. How are you, Patrick?
Elliot, I'm very, very well and it's good to see you here today. Furthermore, it's good to be in the company of key contributor Connell Smith. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be back as always.
Fantastic. Let's get started.
Three Musketeers. Okay, so we are returning as a threesome, as it were. What would you like to tell us, Pat? What's been happening over the last few weeks?
Big news. Obviously, the previous podcast alluded to the fact that we had a publication coming out. I'm pleased to say, Elliot, we're now bona fide, in print, real authors of real books, virtual and paper. So that's great news. We've got an ISBN and everything.
We have an ISBN and everything. Just today, also, we had the good news about the book. What was the good news that we saw?
Well, we're top bestsellers, if you want to call it that, in three separate categories.
That's fantastic.
History for teenagers and young adults. I think that's pretty great. What do you think, Mr. Smith?
Oh, I think it's very impressive. And from the read that I've had, looks extremely good. And I'd hardly recommend it to the listeners of the
You'd
podcast.
You'd hardly recommend it, did
heartily
you?
Heartily recommend.
What's the name of the book, Pat?
It is 33 Easy Ways to Improve Your History Essay. So if you search on Amazon for that title, you'll be offered two versions, the Kindle version and the paperback version. If you are looking for a good deal, if you've got Kindle Unlimited, I think it is, it's free for you to read any time. So get in and get on. We hope you enjoy it and we hope you find it useful, especially given that it's a key period and we're in the uprun in period two examination. So go grab a copy, borrow a copy, look at a copy, get a copy, read a copy. I think that sums it up.
Absolutely. So this is what we're going to do today. This is a topic that particularly interests me because I'm a big fan of American history. And this is actually part of one of the courses that we study at the school in which we teach. We're going to have a look at the causes of the American Revolution, the causes of the Declaration of Independence, or whichever you'd like to call it. Essentially, what we're going to do is we're going to try and determine the key causes of the revolution and perhaps, if we can, isolate, separate one or two of the more important causes. Just as a bit of an aside, I wrote a blog article for www.versushistory.com for our blog. About the causal web, the hierarchy of causes and the web of causes that are integral to a very, very solid and sophisticated essay. So if you want, go and have a look at this. But today we're having a look at the causes of the American Revolution. Now, we cannot do everything in a 20-minute podcast, so we're going to choose two, three, maybe four very specific causes, and we're going to pick those apart and then put them back together again and give our judgment. So, Pat, I was going to ask you if you start, but why don't I give, first of all, an overview before you get into one of the causes?
Let's go for it, yeah.
Okay. So, on the 4th of July, 1776, the Second Continental Congress, representing the 13 British colonies of North America, declared their independence from British rule. Just 7 years later, the defeated remnants of the British Army departed North America for good. They were leaving behind them the memory of a British colonial treasure, which had once promised to help fund the construction of an unprecedented imperial expansion. Now it was buried under the sand of an arrogantly short-sighted British imperial policy, one that combined aggressive taxation, paternalist trade strictures, and an anachronistic understanding of the political concerns of colonial subjects. But let us go back a little bit. What caused the 13 colonies of North America to openly rebel in the first place against an imperial control of Britain, and why were they the cause of such an irreparable rift in the relationship between the two, leading to the American War of Independence and, ultimately, to the formation of the Declaration of Independence and the incorporation of the United States? Okay, Pat, why don't you start us off?
Okay, let's go. I mean, in terms of America and the 13 colonies, it's difficult to know where to start because geographically it's huge and we're dealing with a lot of time here between the first British voyage in 1585, led by Sir Richard Grenville, all the way up till 1776 when independence is declared by Thomas Jefferson. We're dealing with a lot of time here, so it's really important that we judiciously pick where we're going with this. I'm going to be focused on Enlightenment thinking and the nature of the colonists themselves, which led them on their trajectory towards independence. Okay, so the first voyage was led in 1585. That was followed by the failed Roanoke colony. And the first child born to English parents, she was called Virginia Dare. No one knows what happens to her, but happened to her, by the way. And that was followed by Jamestown in 1607, named after King James, the first Stuart King of England. And then we get the Mayflower in 1620, led by pilgrims and Puritans. I think that sums up where we're going with this. There was push and pull factors, pushing people away from Europe and pulling them towards the New World. We have Puritans, farmers, pioneers, and also criminals from London. Prior to Australia being the proverbial dumping ground for Britain's criminals, America was the recipient. Now, what I'm trying to say here is very fractious, very diverse collection of people. Puritans being pushed away by perceived persecution, but also being drawn towards the New World because they could establish the world along their own lines, a new world, a godly world. Farmers looking for new opportunities, maybe leaving Scotland, Ireland, or central England. And pioneers. Now, what I'm trying to say here is because it was so fast, because we're dealing with such a large amount of time and such a diverse group of people, in the New World, there was a wide degree of self-government. In the 13 colonies, this was not a group of any sort. They were 13 separate colonies, essentially 13 separate countries with their 13 separate ideologies. Now, it was decentralized. So whilst the British flag did wave, their allegiance to the flag was questionable. They felt of themselves as English, especially after 1763. They were proud to be English and not French and Spanish after the Seven Years' War. But ultimately, they were allowed to do what they wished as long as they spoke English, were largely Protestant, and waved the British flag. Now, a quote here, if I may.
We do like this.
Yeah, some historiography from Piers Brendan. It says here, the empire carried within it, from birth, an ideological bacillus that would prove fatal. This was Edmund Burke's paternalistic doctrine that colonial government was a trust. It was to be so exercised for the benefit of subject people that they would eventually attain their birthright, freedom. Now, this ideological bacillus is essentially this, I would contend. If you are going to allow white British settlers to go abroad to be free and to have their free rights as Englishmen, they are essentially going to want to claim those rights and take them to their logical conclusion, which is freedom. Now, just a final point I'm going to make on Enlightenment thinking. This is the era of John Locke. This is the era of rejecting absolutist monarchy and the divine right of a king if the king isn't acting in the best interest of his people, which is ultimately going to be the Patriots' claim about King George III. A diverse group of people with new ideas establishing a new world along very, very separate lines, albeit flying a British flag.
So am I right in thinking then that you're saying from the very birth of America, inevitably independence was going to happen and a clash would come with the British?
I wouldn't say it was inevitable, but there is definitely an argument from Piers Brendan that it was. I've got another quote for you. In truth, the ramshackle imperial edifice had never been securely based. Those who ventured abroad were obviously wedded to independence. At least as warmly as their kith and kin at home, they cherished the ideal of English liberty. So I think I would combine that with the fact that prior to 1763, when the British become far more hands-on with the 1763 proclamation, the end of salutary neglect, it's the ideal of English liberty as espoused by Magna Carta in 1215, in addition to the British hands-off rule of governance, which allowed this idea of independence to take root and become fertilised, which meant after 1763, after the end of the Seven Years' War, these settlers are going to be very, very difficult to pacify and contain. Add into that heady mixture some rather ill-advised hands-on legislation and attempts to tax by the British government. We're going to have problems for the British government, which is ultimately going to mean independence.
Right. So basically what you've done there is you've created a context, a foundation and a backdrop. We have a milieu, I would say, into which the British imperial machine is going to try and function. And they're functioning almost always against this Enlightenment thinking, which the United States, or America rather, was the 13 colonies, was fundamentally founded upon. And so really their view, their worldview, was a view of independence from paternalist government. And as a result, we were always really going to see a response to any kind of control without representation on their behalf, political representation.
I think you've got it. They spoke English. They thought of themselves as Englishmen, enjoying the rights of Englishmen.
Right. Okay. Well, can I just jump in here? Because I think that feeds in quite nicely into one of the causes that I want to discuss. You mentioned salutary neglect earlier on. Could you just clarify what that is? Because I want to talk about that a little bit afterwards.
Yes. Prior to 1763, the British had been very hands-off with their imposition of taxation and governance. They'd essentially allowed the 13 American colonies to function as they wished, as long as they swore loyalty to Britain, acknowledged the king as their king, and generally did as they were asked to. So essentially, the Americans were given the responsibility to self-govern, albeit under the aegis of the British Crown. Now, after 1763, there's a change. Britain has won the Seven Years' War, but they are now in debt. And furthermore, there's a feeling on behalf of British people in Britain that the Americans should pay their way. So that salutary neglect comes to an end.
Right. So with the salutary neglect ceasing, what we do is we have essentially a paradigm shift in the way that the British control their North American territory. And what this does is it leads up to one of the, you might want to call it one of the early causes, or at least the early signifiers of what is to come. And that's the Boston Massacre. But in order to understand that, I think it's important to just dwell a little bit on the situation after the end of the Seven Years' War in 1763. At the end of the war in 1763, as you said, Great Britain has a massive financial and economic burden. It has spent an inordinate amount of money. It has a phenomenal national debt that must be serviced and must be paid. So what they begin to do is they begin to tax the 13 colonies more. They have New Canada that has been given to them, and a massive expanse of new territory that has been ceded to them as a result of the victory in the Seven Years' War. And these territories need administering. They need defending, and so much of this expenditure, this new expenditure, they believed would come from the 13 colonies. And so they began to impose these new taxations, one of which was called the Townshend duties. It wasn't just that these taxes were a burden, it was that they had come almost directly after a period of almost no burden of taxes. And so the contrast was extreme. Extreme to the point where the 13 colonies began to organize themselves in resistance, no more so than in what can be found in the city of Boston. Now, there was a chap called Sam Adams. And if you wanted to find the revolutionary patriotic spirit, it was to be found within this man. Now, this man, yes, he was an agitator, but he was a political agitator. He created and led what became known as the Sons of Liberty. And pretty much wherever there was a challenge to be met or there was a protest to be had, particularly in Boston, he was probably behind it. Now, what he did was he organized resistance against particularly the British military presence in Boston that had increased significantly after the closure of New York as a port. And when Boston experienced an increase in British military garrisoning, he took to the streets with the Sons of Liberty. And what we ended up with was a confrontation in Boston, pretty much as a result of the Townshend duties, as well as the increased military presence in Boston, which leads to what becomes known as the Boston Massacre in 1770, whereby a number of civilians, I say civilians in inverted commas, you can't see, because they were there as agitators under the aegis of the Sons of Liberty. And this really can be seen as, if not the actual, then certainly the symbolic beginning of the physical confrontation between the British and the Americans. And as a result, we must consider this as one of the causes. Now, I know that Connell would like to take over here, perhaps in relation to the taxation or to Boston.
Yeah, so I think that my main argument is going to be that the cause of the revolution was ultimately down to tea. If people know anything about the American Revolution, the kind of image that often comes to head is that of the Boston Tea Party, where £10,000 worth of tea is dumped over the side of three boats and out of principle. And so I think it's interesting to pick up on what Patrick was saying earlier, this idea of principle and liberty, this enlightenment thinking. I think that is crucial, but I think it's the fact that it clashes with profit for the British. So
yes.
We have a clash between liberty versus empire. Ultimately, the flashpoint for the American Declaration of Independence really comes from the Tea Act, which is passed in 1773. So for this, it's crucial to understand that America is just one cog within the British Empire as a whole. There is no point, so according to John Darwin, there is no point in engaging an empire unless it increased British trade. A profitless empire was a contradiction in terms. And ultimately, at the time that we are talking about here in America, there was a big issue in another part of the empire. The East India Company was running out of cash. The East India Company, which is a huge financial boon to the British, bringing in huge amounts of money from the tea trade and from the spice trade. And it's interesting to note, you mentioned the Townshend Act earlier, which put tariffs and duties on lots of different products. After the Boston Massacre, most of those duties are removed, but one that is not
is the tea.
Exactly, and which shows how important that is. So what the Tea Acts do in simple terms is they allow tea from the East India Company to be traded directly with America. Previously, it had to go through British ports and pay various duties. What this does is it allows the British a route to try and increase the profits of the East India Company. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to solve one empire problem by passing it over to another. In America, there is a big problem at this time, so the British perceive it, with tea smuggling.
Yeah.
So bringing tea into the country and avoiding taxes. And the taxes that the East India Company and the British are putting on the tea that comes in is minimal. But
So what you're saying is that the tea that the British are bringing in is actually going to be cheaper than the tea the Americans would ordinarily get.
I am saying
so
that.
So why is that? That's a weird thing to be upset about.
It is a really weird thing to be upset about. Normally we're guided by our wallets, aren't we? And anything that expands the wallet is a good thing. But that's where I think we can't ignore what Patrick was arguing earlier.
Mm.
Clearly this is about principle. You know, challenging this lucrative smuggling trade does two things. It imposes a tax many Americans, many patriots oppose in principle. Niall Ferguson says it was the constitutional principle, the right of the British Parliament to levy taxes on the American colonists without their consent, that was the bone of contention. So lots of people are arguing, actually, it's not about the money in this instance, it's about the principle.
Yeah.
But it does also, if you think about it, if you're an American patriot engaged in smuggling activities or supporting it, it does threaten to undercut your source of income. So it's kind of doing two things. And so when those Tea Acts come about, I think that's the flashpoint that really kicks the British into action. When the Patriots, the Sons of Liberty that you mentioned earlier, when they go onto these ships dressed up as Native Americans and throw them over the side, it's a really direct challenge to the British. And the sort of challenge that an empire of the size of Britain with the kind of proud nature of Britain can't really ignore. And so I think it's that really sets in motion the chain of events that leads through the coercive acts, etc., onto the war that begins at Lexington and Concord.
I think that's a very, very good argument. I think the root of this comes back to when the English left England to make their little Englands across the Atlantic in the New World, they brought with them their ideas of English law. Magna Carta, the right to representation. And Niall Ferguson says the colonists regarded their own assemblies as equivalent in status to the Westminster Parliament. They wanted their assemblies to be put on a par with Westminster. And Piers Brendan says the empire might have worked if the Americans had sent members of Parliament to Westminster. The fundamental issue here, I think, is the fact that the Americans believed they hadn't assented to these taxes. They hadn't been consulted. They were being imposed without their consent, and their own legislators before 1763, which had largely been supreme in de facto terms, were being rode over and not being consulted. So essentially for the British, the issue had really become the issue of which legislature is supreme. Is it Parliament in Westminster, or is it those in America? And Lord North was caught between a rock and a hard place. Parliament did not want to acquiesce to America, and the Americans did not want to acquiesce to Parliament. So when those English people left Norfolk and Boston in the UK and made their new Norfolks and Bostons in America, they took with them the belief that they were Englishmen and they were not subjects of subjects. They were subjects of the crown and they should be consulted, not dictated to.
So it's interesting because you seem to be saying, therefore, that it's a clash of two competing principles, the British principle and the American principle, whereas I'm arguing that it's perhaps profit versus principle. So what role do you think that in that economic argument plays? Do you think that's just irrelevant? Do you think that's just the sphere in which we see this principle playing out?
Niall Ferguson highlights the fact that in terms of capacity to pay, in terms of the British Empire, those in New England were some of the most wealthy in the world at the time. They were better educated, they were more literate, they had larger families, more land than their fellow countrymen, if you like, in England. So the capacity to pay, that was never in question. It was the principle they were being dictated to and they were not being consulted with over issues of taxation.
Can I just jump in here? I think the rallying cry that we're all very familiar with from the Patriots combines both the financial aspect but also the political aspect. And the rallying cry is, of course, no taxation without representation. So I think it's important to acknowledge that finances and the wallets
Definitely.
And the economic considerations are exceptionally important, but also it's the ideology, it's the political representation and the political value and the political currency that also is embedded in the causes of these this revolution. Just very quickly, you talked about the Tea Act and then the Boston Tea Party the resistance to the Tea Act helping to cause the Boston Tea Party. Even back in England, in the Houses of Parliament, in the House of Commons, there was a split in the British politicians between those who supported these restrictive taxes and those who didn't. For example, Edmund Burke, he spoke about the Tea Act in 1773, trying to convince the Commons not to, or rather to withdraw it. And he says, if this be the case, that the Act be considered legal slavery, ask yourselves this question: will they be content in such a state of slavery? So he is actually equating these repressive taxes from afar as being contingent with slavery.
Which is interesting, given your point earlier about that leading to cheaper tea.
Yes.
But it shows that there's that principle of taxation, no representation, is equivalent to slavery. People who have no control over their own life, but
yeah.
have actions dictated unto them by others.
And even going a little bit further, once the Boston Tea Party took place, there was harsh repression. There was a payment that was exacted by the British, particularly in Boston, but across the colonies through what became known as the Coercive Acts of 1774, which increased military presence, closed down Boston until the tea that had been thrown overboard from the Eleanor, the Dartmouth, and the Beaver was to be paid for. Nicky and Brendan Christie, they say that the impact of the British hardline policies in Boston was to drive all 13 colonies into outright rebellion. Because right at the beginning, Pat said that these were 13 separate colonies. But what they became was they became galvanized in response to these taxation issues or these repressive policies into a unified whole. And that was really the problem that the British faced, which then fed into the Declaration of Independence.
Can I come in on Thomas Paine? Is that all right? I was going to mention him earlier. I completely forgot about the chap. Okay, John Darwin says, what perhaps mattered more than America's developed economy in the revolutionary prelude was the existence of a wealthy, highly educated elite with the intellectual self-confidence to imagine a separate national future. Now, I think there, who we may be referring to is George Washington. And many of the Virginia planters and Bostonian merchants sent their children, because they were so wealthy in comparison to the average Englishman, they sent their children back to England to be educated. Now, that meant that when people like Thomas Paine, when he published his pamphlet, Common Sense, which was really a huge kick against the idea of monarchical rule, this could really gain traction because people in Massachusetts could read these pamphlets, or maybe in England they couldn't. They could read these newspapers, understand these cartoons and handbooks and almanacs. So Thomas Paine, when he produces this pamphlet, which was one of many, but it's definitely the most celebrated, he was really talking to the preaching to the converted. So in terms of America, in terms of firing up this revolutionary sentiment, it was easier in America because they were so well educated in general, quite wealthy, and they could essentially access this revolutionary tide, whereas maybe in England they couldn't have done.
So a lot of your points revolve around the different, or the galvanizing societal and cultural principles of the patriots and the Americans. They were galvanized because not only did they have an ideology that was directed towards independence and enlightenment freedoms, but also it was facilitated by, or they were facilitated by, a higher level of education. Yep. And so on.
And some really clumsy British legislation, clumsy British enforcement of this legislation. So that's where I'm going to go with it, but I completely accept your arguments.
So...
Take your hand at me.
So, what now?
Well, I think we should probably draw things towards a close, shouldn't we, with our conclusions on...
I think so. I think...
So, do you want to give us your synopsis then?
Okay, so the synopsis is, it brings us back, I think it behooves us to go back to the beginning and remind ourselves that we were selecting a few elements that fed into the Declaration of Independence, the War of Independence. I chose essentially the Boston Massacre and the issue of restrictive taxes. You took into account, Connell...
Still restrictive taxes, but perhaps the principle of taxes and the clash of empire and profiting from it on the British side with the principles that Patrick's illuminated for us about representation, liberty.
Okay. You've summed up what I was going to say. Should we just quickly say what we actually think in a nutshell?
Go on then, you first.
I think 1763 is a turning point, the end of salutary neglect of the British hands-on approach. From 1763 onwards, the British will try to tax America. They will station customs officials in America. The 1763 proclamation line by King George says there can be no settlement west of the Appalachian Mountains, and that will irk pioneers and settlers who want cheap land. So essentially 1763 is a big turning point, but quite often in American syllabi they mention the Mutiny or Quartering Act, where there's potentially going to be stationing of British troops in America. So against the idea of Magna Carta and British liberties, the Americans come to see British redcoats as not there to help them and protect them from the French and Spanish, but really just to implement punitive taxes.
Which you see expressed in the Bill of Rights as soon as America is set up. So, yeah, I think I probably agree with you. I think the real... causes is the shift in British policy. If you have had a hands-off approach, people get used to it, people expect liberty, and like you say, they've gone there expecting liberty. And when that is taken away from them, and they can educate themselves and see that it's being taken away from them, and the understand and disseminate the philosophical basis of that, then I think Britain and the Patriots are very much on a collision course from the early 1760s. I guess the reasons it happens particularly when it did would come down to the individual things like the Boston Massacre, the Tea Act, etc. But I think the general trend for conflict and eventually therefore independence was very much underway by the 1760s, as you say.
Fantastic. You've got about 60 seconds in it.
Okay, 60 seconds. We don't like monocausal, but I'm going to dump a lot of my eggs into the basket. The basic, I'm going to say, arrogance and intransigence of the British rule. They were entirely unfamiliar with colonies asking for things and maybe demanding things. The point where the Continental Congress, they actually, essentially, they sent a missive to King George, and I forget exactly what it's called, forgive me, where they basically pleaded and said, we're very, very sorry, we still want to be part of the British Empire, we just need your help. And he didn't even read it, he just threw it in the bin and said, hang the lot of them. So my view is just gross stubbornness and unfamiliarity with imperialism being a two-way street.
Yeah, this was probably the last period, King George III, where the monarch had executive power. So it wasn't just Parliament they were dealing with.
Yeah.
They were dealing with a King George III who supported his Parliament in many things, especially with the Coercive Acts, etc. So this was a difficult time to be a patriot, but also a difficult time to be Lord North, I think. Who was the Prime Minister at the time.
Yeah. Now, if we draw that to a close, can I just mention something? This is maybe a bit selfish of me. Great Britain, they ultimately obviously lost the colonies, the American colonies, and in about 50 years, they're going to almost lose another set of colonies. Lower and Upper Canada.
It took me a while to work out where you were going.
Lower and Upper Canada, the territories that they inherited from France after the Seven Years' War. Patrick and I have written for Versus History an article an academic article about Lord Durham and his contribution to the Canadian issue, as we're calling it, which will be published next week, hopefully, on Amazon. So if you're interested in finding out whether or not the British are going to repeat the same mistakes of 50 years earlier, then perhaps download this as we publish it next week. I know Connell's going to download it. Aren't you, Connell?
Certainly will.
That's two with, books
with
in 2 weeks.
With an invitation like that, I can't say no, can I?
Two books in 2 weeks. That's
two books in 2 weeks.
That's
J.K. Rowling, eat your heart out.
Oh, it's going to be a struggle to keep that up, isn't it?
Certainly is. So just on a separate note, we've got a blog now. It's open to any teachers, anyone that wants to write for us. We've had Mike Towers very kindly write
absolutely.
For us. Thank you to Mike. It's a great article on the threat of revolution in Britain between 1816 and 1820. So if you're a history teacher, if you're a history buff, if you're just someone that likes history, feel free to drop us a line and we'll happily publish it.
Absolutely,
no problem.
Absolutely.
There you go.
So, with that said, I'll say my goodbyes.
I'll say one goodbye.
Au revoir. Versus History. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for downloading and listening to this edition of Versus History. Subscribe. Visit us at our website, www.versushistory.com.